This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You want to know how closely everybody's keeping an eye on the Detroit bailout? The White House put out a statement about it this afternoon. Nothing substantive, mind you, just wanted to say they'd received the plan from Congress. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Monday, the 8th of December. Good to have you with us. And just in case you're curious, the White House got its first look at the proposed bailout package for Detroit at about 2:40 this afternoon, Washington time. It's not so much a bridge to the future as it is a bridge to, like, next March. $15 billion, plus or minus. That's about what everybody's expecting it'll take to get Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler out of their short-term jam. To convince congressional skeptics, though, the money is also going to come with plenty of strings attached. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is on the auto beat today. Hello, John.
Hello, Kai.
All right, so strings attached, what kinds of conditions are on these loans?
Well, there's 5% annual interest for the first 5 years, and it jumps to 9% after that. This deal also limits stock dividend payments by the companies. It limits executive salaries. It gives taxpayers an equity stake in the car companies. There's also a cabinet-level board to oversee the company's finances, and that board will be headed up by a single overseer who's being dubbed a car czar. Now, critics say the government shouldn't be in the car-making business at all, but Joan Claybrook, a former administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, says the oversight board has to impose strict accountability.
They need to have the authority and the capacity to oversee in great detail with sufficient funding and staff to keep close track of the Detroit company's progresses. They should be very, very much on top of what decisions are being made by the companies in terms of their future designs and their capacity for that.
Let's take accountability to the next logical step, John. What about current management? Is Rick Wagner going to stick around at GM?
Well, you know, their future is ultimately going to be decided by this government oversight board. But over the weekend, Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd said that GM CEO Rick Wagner specifically should step down. Now, GM issued a statement defending Wagner, saying that its employees, its dealers, suppliers, and the board of directors believe that he is the person to lead GM through difficult times. But his fate will be up to that oversight board.
And what about the White House, John? Because obviously Congress sent down the language. The White House has it. What's going to happen?
Well, they've raised already at least one objection to the Democrats' plan. The president wants more guarantees of the long-term viability of these car companies. The Democrats' plan calls on the industry to have that plan in place, but not until March 31st.
All right, John Dimsdale in Washington. Thanks, John.
You're welcome, Kai.
President-elect Barack Obama said on Meet the Press Sunday that he's in favor of some kind of rescue package for Detroit. He didn't have too many nice things to say, though, about the way carmakers have been doing business and how they got themselves into this trouble. The president-elect has been fairly guarded in his public pronouncements as to what ought to be done economically before he takes office, even as some on both sides of the aisle are calling for him to be more involved. To talk about that, we've called Jim Thurber. He's the director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. Professor Thurber, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
You know, the talk, obviously, today on Capitol Hill is of the auto bailout, but there's also talk of Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, going back to get the second half of the TARP money, the bailout money, the original $700 billion worth. Do you think the president-elect ought to be weighing in more forcefully on whether that should happen or not?
He is weighing in on this issue. He could have more force. I think he's doing it behind the scenes. I think he would like to keep as much money as possible and political capital to spend after he's president of the United States. I think that his preference would be to make the decisions about how that $350 billion should be spent. He's already said that it should be spent for infrastructure and other issues, not just on banks. And there's not much more that he can do without acting like he's the president of the United States at this point.
What's your sense of the tension between the Obama team and the Bush administration?
I think there always is a tension between a lame duck president and the next person who's coming in who has specific ideas about what to be done. But Obama needs to say things about the economy, and he is about the big three automobile manufacturers. He is with respect to investment in the infrastructure to create jobs. So he does say there's only one president at a time. And then he says, however.
What does he have to look out for every time he opens his mouth?
He has to look out for statements that will affect the market. The market, to a certain extent, is feelings, psychology about things. When he appointed a new Secretary of Treasury, the market went up. If he had some bad appointments, it would go down. I think he is saying the right things to assure the market that he's going to use fiscal policy and push monetary policy indirectly to try to get the economy going.
Professor James Thurber is the director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. Jim Thurber, thanks a lot for your time.
It's good to be here.
Baseball fans reading the Chicago Tribune today might have found the brightest spot in an otherwise grim news day for the Tribune's parent company, called the Tribune Company. The Chicago Cubs are specifically not part of the bankruptcy plan the Tribune filed this morning, but the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune are. The company owes about $13 billion in debt after taking itself private last year, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Despite the dire condition of the newspaper industry, few companies seek bankruptcy protection.
It's exceptional for a newspaper company to go into bankruptcy. In fact, I can't recall one doing it in the last 30 or 40 years.
That's media consultant John Morton.
Tribune Company, compared with some others, publishes more large city newspapers. And it's those kinds of newspapers that have suffered most in this advertising downturn.
Ad revenue is down 10 to 20% across the industry. But when the Tribune went private, it took on $13 billion in debt. Ken Doctor is a news industry analyst for the research firm Outsell.
We knew that when Sam Zell finalized the purchase of the Tribune just a year ago, that it was a house of cards.
That's not to say that the LA Times or the Baltimore Sun are unprofitable. John Morton says all the Tribune papers are profitable. But the company's lenders insist it meets certain cash flow requirements.
So you may be profitable, but you may not be profitable enough at all these newspapers to do that.
The Tribune turned to Plan B, selling assets. But between the recession and the credit squeeze, it's been unable to unload the Chicago Cubs or other properties. So Doctor says the Tribune is cutting back on paper, print, and staff.
The iconic nature of the Tribune Company is slowly ebbing away. And I think most importantly for the readers of those newspapers, they've noticed that the journalism is ebbing away.
Publications like the Christian Science Monitor are going internet only, but Doctor says online ad revenues can't support as many reporters.
Since there's so much less money online than there is in print, that means instead of having 200 reporters in your newsroom, you might be able to afford 20 or 40.
or not at all. Analysts expect some newspapers will disappear altogether, perhaps as soon as next year. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders had a fine time. We will have the details when we do the numbers. About the only unknown about the stimulus package that's going to happen early in the Obama administration is how big it's going to be. $900 billion? And even trillion, anybody? Just as they did this past spring, lawmakers in the White House are going to settle on a package, distribute the money, and hope it does the trick. Whether it is going to work any better, we don't know yet. But commentator Susan Lee thinks there's a way to help Congress be smarter about it.
Can you hear that train a-coming? Yep. A stimulus package is rolling around the bend, and it's coming despite the fact that stimulus plans either don't work or work in ways not intended. Now, I understand the need to do something in the face of a dreary economy, but good intentions aren't enough. Maybe there's a way of encouraging better choices and improving our odds of success. What if we made Congress put real skin in the game? What if we mandated that any congressperson who votes in favor of the stimulus must put his or her money behind that vote? Here's how it might work. Intrade, an online prediction market, offers an interesting way to bet on outcomes, like the direction of the economy. Take, for instance, the Intrade contract that stipulates there'll be a recession in 2009. If the U.S. has two successive quarters of negative GDP growth in 2009, then buyers of that contract win. Since lawmakers will be blabbing about how the stimulus package will boost economic growth, they are essentially betting against a continuing recession. And so they should be required to put their own money where their mouths are and make a formal wager on the outcome. And let's say, to give the plan real bite, congressional supporters ought to spend 5% of their income on these contracts. If the stimulus fails and the recession continues, then Congress would have to make good on their bets. Supporters of the stimulus package would have to pay up. And as a bonus, maybe the people on the other side of these contracts, wagering against the success of the stimulus, would be taxpayers. So if it doesn't work, Congress will have to pay for its mistaken policy, and taxpayers could take home the profit. Then at least somebody would have made money. Bottom line, just maybe the possibility of real money losses will make Congress people more cautious about voting in favor of a stimulus.
Susan Lee is a weekly columnist at Forbes.com. If you have something to say to us, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Today's an important day on the Muslim calendar. It's the beginning of Eid al-Adha, the festival of sacrifice, a four-day celebration that marks the end of the annual pilgrimage to Mecca. Families often share meals with neighbors and give money to the less fortunate. Since September 11th, some recipients of that goodwill, Muslim charities, have been under a magnifying glass. The government's been watching them pretty closely, and that's made donating complicated and sometimes risky. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports now on a new program that may help change that.
Sharif Rosen stands outside the Ummah Clinic in South Los Angeles. He's community director there.
We're just blocks from the flashpoint of the Los Angeles uprisings of 1992, and that really forms the backdrop in which Ummah Clinic was founded.
Ummah stands for the University Muslim Medical Association. It's one of the first owned and operated Muslim community clinics in the nation. UCLA medical students opened the clinic after the riots in 92 ripped through the neighborhood. The founders are Muslim, but the community they serve is mostly African American and Latino.
They created an institution basically from scratch that is now responsible for caring for over 20,000 of Los Angeles' poorest families.
The clinic relies on donations for about one-third of its operating budget. Most of those come from the Muslim community, and that's become a problem. Since 9/11, many Muslim-run charities have found themselves scrutinized by the government. Officials are looking for ties to terrorist groups. And donors have been scared off by the possibility that they might be targeted for the same reason. UMA's president and CEO, Yasser Aman, says he's often on the phone reassuring potential donors about the clinic's work in South Los Angeles.
You know, concerns or anybody asking just, oh, so what exactly do you do with your money? In fact, you know, the great thing that we can say is that you can just hop onto the 110 freeway, exit Florence, and you'll see where your money goes.
Not everyone can make that trip to see for themselves. Instead, they can take the word of the Better Business Bureau. Its Wise Giving Alliance program evaluates religious charities. The Bureau pores over financial statements, looks at who's on the board, and affiliations to other groups. If the charities make the grade, they get a stamp of approval. The program's been around for a few years, but it only recently began reaching out to Muslim charities. The UMA Clinic is one of the first Muslim groups to apply. The Wise Giving Alliance may help charities protect themselves in the future. That's according to Farhan Akira, the director of Muslim Advocates, a legal aid group.
We also hear from the leadership of American Muslim organizations that they're concerned that they might be next in terms of the federal government, the FBI knocking on their doors, coming and seizing their records, resources, and things like that.
Kara says charities and their donors are frustrated that their money could be confiscated. She hopes the Better Business Bureau partnership will remove those fears.
It helps those donors feel a higher degree of confidence that their dollars are going to go for their intended charitable purpose.
Inside the UMA Clinic in South Los Angeles, Winnie the Pooh drawings share wall space with tapestries from Mecca, and patients chat with nurses. UMA CEO Yasser Aman says he'll do whatever it takes to keep the clinic open permanently. He says local residents pushed for that commitment long ago.
And the response was, and it still resonates with us today, is that we're sick and tired of mobile things. Every time there's a problem in the community, you know, people mobilize in a good way, but at the same time, when money dries up, so does the support.
Aman says that money and support don't come automatically with the Better Business Bureau's stamp of approval. But he hopes it will help them raise enough money to stay open one more day a week and build some new exam rooms. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the program, we're going to start a year-end series on philanthropy. We'll tell you all about something called good gifting and other hot topics in Charity 2008. Coming up, new signage in one of Europe's most romantic cities.
I think it ruins the charm.
Yeah, it ruins the charm of they're putting up
It modernizes
technology.
It too much.
So
too much modernization.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial shot up 298 points today, 3.4% to finish at 8,934. NASDAQ rose 62 points, that's 4.1% to close at 1571. The S&P 500 climbed 33 points, 3.8% to end the day at 909. Construction-based companies did well today, especially those that supply raw materials. U.S. Steel erected a 24% gain. Aluminum giant Alcoa was up 17.5%. Copper producer Freeport-McMoRan hammered out a 19% return. Financials were on the rise as well. Bank of America jumped up 17% today. Wells Fargo and Citigroup were both up more than 9%. Today was a bright spot for Sun Microsystems, up 9.75%, but the server company is still down more than 80% this year. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.74%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at Gather.com. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors releases its monthly index of pending home sales, a measure of housing contract activity. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee holds a hearing on the collapse of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And President-elect Barack Obama is scheduled to meet with former Vice President Al Gore in Chicago to talk about the climate.
I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President-elect Obama's plans for a massive stimulus program gave the stock markets a boost today. Didn't do much to unglue the credit markets, though. And let's remember, for a year or so, we called this whole thing a credit crisis. Those markets are still stuck tight, according to the usual gauge that people look at. I'm talking about something called the LIBOR here. It used to be a pretty obscure financial benchmark that only mattered to bank bureaucrats buried deep in their balance sheets. But not anymore, as Mitchell Hartman reports in today's edition of the Marketplace Decoder.
LIBOR. It sounds like a heavy metal or a rare disease. And it has sickened the financial markets lately. LIBOR stands for London Interbank Offered Rate. At precisely 11 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time every day, the British Bankers Association asks as many as 16 giant banks how much interest they're charging each other to borrow money.
It measures the willingness of one bank to lend to another bank overnight or for 3 months or for 6 months.
Andrew Hilton directs the Center for the Study of Financial Innovation in London.
If the banks are lending to each other, then there's trust in the system and they're prepared to lend to other people as well.
When banks stop trusting each other, they stop lending, and that causes the system to fail. LIBOR acts like a thermometer for a sick economy. The sicker the economy gets, the higher LIBOR goes. Hilton says LIBOR is down from its recent record, but it's still worryingly high.
There's an absence of trust because the banks themselves are best placed to know what kind of rubbish, what kind of toxic assets they've got on their own books, and to make the assumption that other banks are in much the same situation.
And why should the rest of us care about huge banks gouging each other? Brian Bethune's an economist at IHS Global Insight. He says banks pass those higher rates on to you and me.
There are a large number of business loans and consumer loans that are indexed to this LIBOR rate because it's such an important barometer of conditions in the interbank market.
In other words, as LIBOR rises, so does your mortgage and the credit line your boss uses to pay the bills. Right now, Andrew Hilton says, LIBOR is seesawing wildly up and down, and not many overnight loans are being made. That's because of an almost total breakdown of trust between the banks. Hilton says banks are accusing each other of lying to the British Bankers Association about whether they can borrow in the interbank lending market at all, at any price. So LIBOR, the most reliable benchmark we had to gauge the health of the global banking system, has become completely unreliable. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You can check our website for help making sense of the financial crisis. There are more decoders there and some video explainers, too, online at marketplace.org. There's a big media conference in New York City this week. Things kicked off this morning with some pretty depressing statistics for the advertising industry, the industry on which all of those media companies depend so much. Corporate ad spending in this country is expected to fall as much as 9% next year. Hard times in Detroit are part of the cause of the drop. Cars have traditionally spent more than anybody else on marketing. But as Ashley Melton-Tite reports, everybody's pulling back.
These are dark days for Madison Avenue. Matt Coppe is global media strategist with UBS. He says spending on marketing will drop more than 8% next year, and it gets worse if you focus on the traditional print, radio, and TV ads.
This is a big deal. Like, if you take out the internet, we are at minus 11%, and minus 11% is the worst decline in 60 years.
Tom Finneran is with the American Association of Advertising Agencies. He says ad agencies are whipping out pie charts and PowerPoint presentations to demonstrate the bang clients are getting for their buck. He says agencies will sometimes suggest a brand keep advertising but change its focus.
There might be different forms of messaging that might be appropriate in this type of economy.
In tough times, he says, a paper towel brand might want to switch its emphasis from softness to strength and value. Still, he says, when clients cut back on advertising, some industry layoffs are inevitable. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
V Venice is getting it from all sides. The Italian city's just getting over the worst flooding it's had in 20 years. It's still sinking, too, with no real solution in sight for that. And if that's not enough, there is another problem, this one from above. The buildings around its most famous public square, Piazza San Marco, are crumbling. Chunks of buildings are falling off. Megan Williams reports a possible solution has tourists and locals a little nervous.
A gondola ride through the canals of Venice. Then a stop at Italy's most stunning square, Piazza San Marco, or St. Mark's Square. 900-year-old palaces, archways, and ornate marble form a space so intimate and elegant that Napoleon dubbed it the living room of Europe. 20 million visitors come each year to enjoy a coffee or ice cream, feed the pigeons, or snap photos. But the buildings that face Piazza San Marco are falling to pieces. It would cost tens of millions of dollars to restore. So Venice's mayor has proposed masking the construction with towering digital billboards. The advertising fees could cover the restoration costs.
I think it ruins the charm.
Yeah, it ruins the charm of they're putting up
It modernizes
technology.
It too much.
So
too much modernization.
John and Debbie from New Hampshire came to Venice to see Old World Charm, not Times Square.
I got to figure out another way to gather up some money.
But ads are tough to turn down. This year, for the first time, Venice allowed billboards just outside the square. But they're not electronic, with flashing lights and glare. Alessandra De Bigottina is an Italian art curator. She says she'd hate to see Venice hand over its historic squares to advertisements.
I think that so important spaces in Italy are cultural spaces. They are not for advertising. But on the other side, I understand that they cost so much for the renovation of the building cannot be paid by the government because we don't have the money.
It's a dilemma other Italian cities have had to deal with. Milan tried to put up advertising screens on its famous Duomo a decade back. But protesters who feared the ads would never come down blocked the plan. Nicola is a waiter at the famous Gran Café in Piazza San Marco. The café was closed down 3 years ago when chunks of wall fell onto outdoor tables. The city covered up the renovation work with an unsightly white net. Customers fled. Nicola doesn't want the big billboards. He says, why not compromise?
Paint a beautiful image onto the screen that depicts the cafe, the archway, the windows of the building, and have this cover the restoration work. Even put a tiny ad in the corner of it. I am sure people still come to sit here instead of going to the other cafes.
And if there have to be ads, says fellow waiter Fabio, then make them tasteful. Only for products like luxury cars or designer goods.
Not McDonald's, that's for sure. I mean, come on, the ads need to be for high-class things. That would be fine.
The mayor's office wants to see how much demand there'll be for the ads before pressing ahead. Whatever it decides, the city has to move soon. As the cafe band plays on, Piazza San Marco is falling to bits. In Venice, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a lesson in how easy it is to spend $335 billion. The Treasury Department announced today it's only got $15 billion left out of the original slice of the bailout package it got 2 months ago. Remember, the TARP came in two even chunks of $350 billion apiece. Treasury ran down the details today. $250 billion to banks for a capital infusion. $40 billion to the insurance company AIG, $25 billion to Citigroup, that's another $25 billion, and the last $20 billion to the Federal Reserve to boost consumer loan programs. Congressman Barney Frank said today he thinks the odds of Congress approving the second slice of $350 billion are pretty slim unless the administration promises to do more to prevent foreclosures. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow pumped up 298 points, 3 4/10%. The NASDAQ rose 62 points, 4 1/10%. The S&P 500 jumped 35 points. That's 4% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, the big buzz in philanthropy this year is starting small.
Micro-consignment, micro-franchising, micro-endowment, micro-giving, micro-philanthropy. Big ideas made small.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.